Okay. Last week, as you recall, we ended talking about Karna, Radheya. He's also called, he calls himself after his mother. That was his own name for himself, Radheya, because he loved his mother, his foster mother, because he'd been abandoned as a baby. And then he went through the double cycle of being cursed first by his guru for lying to him about his caste. And he was cursed by his guru to say, in the moment that you really need it, you'll forget the mantras that you need. And then afterwards, he accidentally shot and killed the wife of a rishi, the cow of a rishi. And then the rishi told him that you're in the moment of your greatest effort, your chariot wheel will get stuck in the mud, and you will be as helpless as my cow was when you killed her. Karna. He represents in the story, and he's in such a strange character, he represents in the story the desire to be happy in this world. And he's just a terribly complex character because he's noble and he's good and he ends up being very famous and he's brave and courageous, but he's just doomed never to fulfill what he needs to fulfill because it's simply not destined that we should be happy in this world. So that's the reality he has to face. Okay, so now what happens is we're going to leave that whole story, the groundwork has been set, and now we're going to walk away from it. Gentlemen, do you need to both stand there that whole time, or is it just a little disconcerting to me because, you don't look comfortable or relaxed? Thank you very much. Drona now has trained both the Kauravas and the Pandavas in the art of war. And Drona, of course, doesn't mind at all sort of showing off what he's accomplished. Drona, just to remind you all, represents the power of habit. And the power of habit is proud of its accomplishments, it wants to show. And also, of course, Drona is very partial to Arjuna, and he arranges this whole tournament. And among the many goals he hopes to achieve is to show off his star pupil Arjuna and to be able to bask in the glory of how powerful he is. So, first of all, Bhima and Duryodhana face off, and they face off. Both of their chosen weapons are maces. And of course, Bhima, as the Pandava brother, and Duryodhana as the head of the Kauravas, there's no love lost between them. So they start out as a demonstration of their prowess, but soon their own actual feelings begin to take over. Instead of it just being a tournament, it becomes much too intent, and so they have to stop them. Bhima represents the power of righteousness, fighting against material desire. He's fighting against wrong thinking. Righteousness fights against wrong thinking, but wrong thinking puts up a mighty struggle. And it starts out as an impersonal battle, but then it gets very personal between them. And so always you have Duryodhana and Bhima going one against the other. Duryodhana instinctively knows that the power of righteousness is going to eventually do him in. And Bhima knows that he can conquer Duryodhana, but still Duryodhana puts up a mighty fight at all times. And so this is how we live. So the next comes the power, the archery contest. And the others do their part, but it's really all about Arjuna. And so Arjuna walks on, and true to Drona's expectation, he absolutely staggers the crowd with his extraordinary ability. No one has ever seen an archer as effective and as powerful as Arjuna is. And Drona is basking in the glory of this, and Yudhishthira and his brothers are strong, and Dhritarashtra, the blind mind, has to pretend that self-control, which is what Arjuna represents, is something that he favors, even though inside he's seething. He really doesn't want Arjuna to be powerful, but he can't come out and say how much he favors his own sons. He has to pretend to be happy about it. So everyone has just universally accepted that Arjuna is the best. But all of a sudden, off in a sort of a side area of the pavilion, this huge commotion starts. And everyone turns over, and this extraordinarily impressive and glorious-looking figure that no one has ever seen enters the pavilion. And it is no one less than Karna himself, Radheya. And he was born with golden earrings and a golden breastplate. and his own father is Surya, the sun. Of course, he was the result of the mantra when his mother said the mantra and invoked the sun god. So this tremendous power comes into the room, and for the first time, there's a great trembling in Yudhishthira's heart because he's never seen anyone as powerful as this man, and he doesn't know who he is. And he says, you know, Arjuna seems to be the most powerful one, but I challenge him to single combat. And just at that moment when that goes out, over in the women's section, there's a huge commotion. And Kunti, the mother of Yudhishthira and the five Pandavas, faints dead away because she recognizes this man is her son. When she put him into the basket because he had the golden earrings and the golden chest plate, she said, my son, when next I see you, I will always know who you are because of this that you wear. Plus, a mother's heart recognized her own. A moment before, Kunti was thinking, how powerful and beautiful are my sons. You know, nothing in the world can ever diminish their greatness. And then, in the way of life, all of a sudden, circumstances change. And her past karma catches up with her. I was having a conversation with someone not too long ago about some difficulties they were facing, and we were talking about other things that had happened in the past in which, you know, the individual had not acted perhaps as honorably as he might have. And I said, what did you think would happen with those dishonorable actions? Did you think they would just go away and you would be able to conveniently never think about them again? No. They lurk on strings of karma, and when the right moment comes in, they balance themselves out. So here, poor Kunti, the mother of the Pandavas, for all her goodness for all these years, nonetheless abandoned that child back at the beginning. And so now that karma comes back around. And before she can say or do anything, she sees that her eldest son is challenging, is going to go to combat against Arjuna. Vidura rushes over to Kunti. Vidura is wisdom incarnate, and he's the one who keeps the balance throughout the whole story. And he just looks at her and he says, it's not the time. It's not the time to speak. So she remains silent. Now, Arjuna is perfectly willing to test his strength against this unknown hero. Arjuna has perfect confidence. Self-control can conquer everything. When you really think about it, it is the greatest hero, is the mastery of oneself. That's what Arjuna always represents. So he's perfectly willing to go to battle, and they're about to start fighting. But one of the elders says, wait a minute. He said, there's rules of Dharma here, that battle can only be between equals. So we know what Arjuna's lineage is. We know where he comes from. We know his family and his training. But who are you? And of course, then, Karna has nothing to say because he's the son of a chariot driver and he is not in the class that would be allowed to compete with Arjuna. Now, Duryodhana realizes that this man is the first he's seen who may have the power, you know, to beat these fearful enemies of his, and plus, material desire has a natural affinity for the desire to be happy in the world. So he interrupts before Karna can say anything, and he said, you know, nobility is not merely a matter of birth. It's self-evident looking at this man that he is of royal lineage. And then Duryodhana, being an impulsively generous character, because no one is all bad, says, well, there's a small kingdom that has no monarch at this time. So I give you that kingdom. And then he asks for the ceremonial things to be brought, and then a formal coronation is done. And all of a sudden, he is a king in his own right. But just as all that happens, this humble-looking man comes forward. And as soon as Radei sees him, it's his father. So this humble man comes, and this newly crowned king who was challenging the greatest hero of all times falls at the feet and touches the feet of his father, because Karna is an honorable man. If he, in that way, if he were dishonorable, he would have taken the moment to repudiate his heritage, but he's always been grateful for what his foster parents did for him. And then, at that point, the because he becomes, it's self-evident that this is his true father, and Radehi acknowledges that this is the man who raised me, Arjuna and the other Pandavas say, well, we're not going to fight with you. And Duryodhana just accuses him of cowardice and puts his arm around Karna. And Karna says, you know, when no one else would believe in me, you have believed in me, and I pledge my life and my honor and my prowess to your cause. So there he is. He was born into the path of righteousness, but the desire to be happy in this world caused him to align himself with material desire instead of spiritual aspiration. Ooh, there's a lesson in there for all of it.
They took
the wrong friends. That, you know, he's the most interesting character to contemplate all through the whole story, because you so want him to succeed, but he never really quite makes it. And there's a certain rather obvious lesson in that, don't you think? We're always just thinking, what would it harm for everything just to work out nicely for me? I mean, you know, why not? I would still love you, God, just as much if it goes my way. Don't you think so? But somehow God doesn't see it that way. Now, when Radeya walks into the tournament and he confronts Arjuna, there's another reality. The father of Karna is Surya, the sun. The father of Arjuna is Indra, the lord of the universe, but also the god of rain. So as the two of them are aligned with each other, cool clouds cover Arjuna and give him the strength of a gentle rain, and the bright sun shines upon Karna, and even as on earth the two suns are fighting, the powers of the sun and the clouds and the rain are combating on a higher level. So now Indra himself becomes concerned, because of course the gods are always watching what's going on down here. We think that we're just operating in the material plane, but the higher realms are also often involved. So Indra knows that every day at noon, Karna, without realizing it, is a devotee of his own father, which is the god of the sun. So every day at noon, he conducts a certain puja to the sun, and he has an unfailing commitment that whatever favor of is asked of him after he conducts his noon worship, he will always grant. You know, this is the greatness of those times when a man's word was everything, and he would promise that. So Indra is concerned for Arjuna, and he has promised that he would help Arjuna in his quest. So he plans the next day that he's going to come to Karna, and he's going to ask a favor of him that will weaken him. Now, Surya knows what Indra is plotting, because in that world they're also working for and against each other all the time. So in a dream that night, Surya, the god of the sun, comes to his son Karna, and he says, tomorrow, you know, someone disguised as a Brahmin is going to ask a favor of you, and under no circumstances should you grant that favor. And Karna says, but I've given my word always to grant that favor. And no matter what that means, my honor is worth more to me than anything. The one redeeming and complex factor of Karna is that even though there's this sense of doom which surrounds him, he realizes that his consciousness, his honor is all that he has. And so no matter what happens, he's always faithful to that. Even though circumstances will not go in the way he wants them to go, and he senses that that's going to happen. So he says to Surya in his dream, I simply can't say no if I am asked. So after the puja the next day, Indra disguises himself as a Brahmin, and he comes up to Karna and he says, what I want from you is the golden earrings that are a part of your body and the golden breastplate that you were born with. And Karna says, I know that you are my enemy, and I know you are asking because you favor, you know, those who are against me. But I have, and if I give you these things, I know it will weaken me, because this is where my power comes from. I was born with these, and they have a divine force for me. And if I remove them from my body, then I will be weakened and defeated. But nonetheless, my good name and my honor and my word are worth more to me than any other victory. So he simply cuts them off his body and hands them to Indra. Now Indra has been vowed to help his own son. At the same time, he's impressed by the nobility and the self-sacrifice of this man. So first of all, he heals the wounds caused by this noble action on the part of Karna. But then he offers him also, he said, I wish to honor you back and I offer you a boon. So we have the curse of the Rishi and then we have the boons, and they sort of balance each other back and forth. Every so often, everything goes great and you get to ask for a boon and it gets to be given to you. So Indra offers Karna a boon, and he knows now that he's dealing with the god Indra. So he asks for a particular weapon of his Shakti weapon. And Indra says, all right, I will give it. I will make it accessible to you, but it can only be used one time. And Karna says, that's all right. I only have one real enemy. And he's, of course, thinking of Arjuna, because Arjuna is the one that he knows has the power to defeat him. Self-control can always defeat everyone. But he says, with this Shakti power, I know I will be able to defeat him. But then Indra says to Karna, I know, he said, I know who your enemy is, but you must understand that Arjuna is under the protection of Krishna. And even, Indra says, my Shakti is not strong enough to defeat Arjuna as long as Krishna protects him. So everybody in the story also knows that Krishna is the Lord himself and comes from somewhere else, and all the rules that apply to everyone do not apply to Krishna. And he says to Indra says to Karna, he says, you will be defeated, he said, but you will also be recognized as one of the greatest heroes on the battlefield, and the glory of your name will live forever. So now Karna realizes he's dealing with such a powerful being. He asks him a question. He says, who is my true mother? Who is my true father? And of course, Indra knows, but it's not the moment for Karna to know. And he says, I cannot tell you. And once again, Karna comes right up to the edge of everything working out for him, and then he's defeated by powers greater than himself. Of course, if Karna had known at that point who was his mother and who was his father, he would have embraced the Pandavas as his own brothers, although he had already given his word and his loyalty to Duryodhana. But you see again how things don't quite work out. There he is, he promised Duryodhana without knowing what he was promising, but the promise was given. All right. So now, Drona, you may remember that all of this started when Drona was friends with King Drupada when they were children. And then Drupada, the king, or the heir to the throne, had promised Drona, who was the son, the poor son of a Brahmin father, when they grew up together in his father's ashram, Drupada had promised Drona that when he came into his inheritance and became king, he would share his kingdom equally with Drona. Okay, Drupada represents, let me just say this for a second. Drona, of course, represents habit, and Drupada represents extreme dispassion for the things of this world. And at the beginning of your spiritual life, habit often works for you and your good friends. But when Drupada actually came into his kingdom and Drona claimed half of it, Drupada just laughed him off. And that was what enraged Drona, and that's why he went out to train these warriors. So now Arjuna and the Kauravas have all been trained up as great warriors, and Drona says, it's time for you to pay me the dakshina, the payment to the guru, it's called. It's what you owe me. And he says, what I want now is I want you to go out and conquer Drupada. I have a certain revenge against him and I want it to be carried out. Now, the Kauravas say they can do it all on their own without any help from the Pandavas. So the Pandavas just wait and let them go forward to Drupada. But they were completely unable to conquer him because Drupada is extreme dispassion, and material desire can hammer at the door, but dispassion has a strong disinclination for the things of this world. And Duryodhana and his minions were not able to conquer him. So then it was the Pandavas' turn. And the Pandavas swept in right away, and with their tremendous power, they took Drupada prisoner. They went right to him. They had no desire to kill anyone. They just captured Drupada, presented him to Drona. Now, Drona had waited all his life for this moment. This was his moment of supreme revenge, and he taunted Drupada with cruel words. You promised me, you broke your promise, you're not an honorable man. You promised me half of your kingdom, and now all of it belongs to me. He said, but I am more magnanimous than you, and I will give half of it back to you. And symbolically, he gives, Drona keeps the southern half, and Drupada keeps the northern half. And Yogananda describes that in his Gita commentary, that habit keeps the lower three chakras and extreme dispassion keeps the upper three. And so the spiritual has to pull on the power of habit and transform it. So they split the kingdom at this point. Dispassion and habit are divided. Then it was all over for Drona. He felt like this was completely settled now. He'd had his revenge. He had half the kingdom which had been promised. And he embraces Drupada as a friend and thinks that they'll live happily ever after. They say here that Brahmin's anger is short-lived, but the anger of a kshatriya festers and festers and festers. Drupada is a kshatriya, and he is anything but willing to take this humiliation calmly. So he walks away from there, resolved in two ways. First, he's going to give birth to a son who has the power to kill Drona. And the son he gives birth to eventually is Dhrishtadyumna, the calm inner light. And the calm inner light has the power to dissolve habit. And he also is so impressed by the prowess and majesty of Arjuna that he also makes a resolution that he will have a daughter, that he will marry to Arjuna. He will honor the hero, and he will defeat the enemy. And so then Drupada walks away with this deep resolution. And in due time, his son Dhrishtadyumna was born, and his daughter Draupadi, and she becomes, of course, the wife of the Pandavas. And in order to have this happen, Drupada goes off and does a great deal of tapasya and gets a boon from the gods, of course, because tapasya gives us the power to overcome our habits. In other words, when we don't continually give in to the power of habit, when we practice austerities and restrain ourselves, then gradually do we develop within us the power to put those habits down forever. So he does the tapasya, he gives birth, dispassion gives birth to the inner light. This dispassion for the world, focused as tapasya, results in the inner vision. And then that inner vision finally dissolves that which seems unconquerable, which is all the samskaras of the past. So, any questions or thoughts before that? Whoa! Okay. It's a big night. So now, back in Hastinapura, where both the Pandavas and the Kauravas still live, Drona's had his tournament. Radeya, Karna now also lives there with Duryodhana. He's a constant unease for Yudhisthira because he can see the power of this warrior. So where he was certain of their ability to overcome the Kauravas, now he's not quite so sure. You see, this is also the other side of it. Duryodhana represents material desire. Yudhisthira is righteousness, calmness in psychological battle, Bhima's righteousness, Arjuna's self-control, power to follow good rules, the yamas and the niyamas. But all of a sudden, the desire to be happy in this world has crept into their lives. And Yudhisthira is always just a little nervous, because he knows that this particular force has a lot of power even over all the greatness that they have. You know, it's a very interesting reality. I was reflecting on this. This takes us into a completely different world. I was thinking of the life of Teresa of Avila, who lived in Spain in the time when the Catholic Church was really in the ascendancy with all their ideas of damnation if you sin and eternal salvation if you don't. And I was just contemplating what an extraordinary power that had over people. And when you sort of read the life of St. Teresa of Avila when she was young, you know, she became very enamored of the idea of becoming a martyr when she was just a child, Because if you just went off and got yourself killed for the cause, then you would be eternally happy. And what a tremendous force that had on everyone's consciousness. People were good, as Master said, not because they were inclined to be good, but because they were terrified of being evil. Eternal damnation is, you know, pretty much of a deterrent, you know. Although, as Swamiji says, you're inclined to ask, then how bad can I be and still get away with it? And that's how the Catholic Church got itself into all the trouble it's in, because it had to start defining just how bad you could be and still get away with it. At what point do you finally get damned? And, you know, how much can I push the edge of the envelope? And then is there a way that I can balance it back out again? And all of those different factors. But on the spiritual path, you know, that we're walking, there's still this tension that we all feel, which is the promise of a greater bliss versus the apparent attractiveness of an immediate satisfaction. And so even the Pandavas, who are so powerfully centered in the force of Dharma, are still made uneasy by the presence of Karna, because he's that force that says, well, maybe we can be righteous and still be satisfied. When we say in this world, what we mean is in the world that we perceive with the senses. You know, why not? And in our particular time and place, we're in this still, in this Kali Yuga Dwapara Yuga shift, we're still in between the time when we were going to hell if we did anything enjoyable or cross the line in any small way, and the belief that there is no hell, there is no Satan, that we can just do whatever we want, and the truth, which is that we are made in a certain way, and if we break the rules of Dharma, then there will be an ensuing pain. Just as I was saying about when we do something unrighteous, where do we think that energy goes? You know, why are we surprised later when in one way or another we are made miserable as a consequence of our own actions? That's the way it works. And we cannot be naive about how subtle these forces are. And that's why Karna in this story is made so powerful and so admirable in so many ways. And he even springs from the same lineage, but he's separated from that lineage at birth and then just keeps making the wrong choices all the way down the line because he's just slightly cursed. He's almost with them, but not quite at all times. So anyway, it's lovely to contemplate that one. Any questions? So back in Hastinapura, they're having a really hard time, because Dhritarashtra has to preside as if impartially over the sons of his dead brother and his own offspring. And he's bound to the sons of Pandu, or the Pandavas, because of Pandu's prowess as a warrior that the kingdom became strong again, because Dhritarashtra himself was not capable as a blind man. It was his brother who made the kingdom powerful, so it would be dishonorable for him not to give due regard to the Pandavas. Plus, Yudhisthira is the oldest. Duryodhana, at the same time, is just eaten up with jealousy and can hardly bear what goes on. And in the meantime, the citizens, of course, are drawn to the righteousness of the Pandava brothers, and the rightful king is Yudhisthira. And so finally, he feels that he just has to, you know, make it clear that Yudhisthira is the heir to the throne, and so he crowns him Yuvraj, it's called, the coming ruler, even though Duryodhana can almost hardly stand it. Dhritarashtra becomes afraid that his son is going to do something rash. And since he himself wishes to get rid of the Pandavas also, he decides that he can plot better than his son. The blind mind thinks it knows what it can really do. And so he comes up with a plan, and he suggests, at Duryodhana's urging, Duryodhana says, look, if we can just get these people out of town for a while, just give me a chance to win the citizens to my cause. He said, I know I can get a hold of this kingdom in such a way that they will always be loyal to me. If this spiritual aspiration would just go away for a while, I think I can convince everyone here that my way is the right way. Isn't that so? Isn't that how we argue with ourselves a lot of the time? Don't we just sometimes think that our spiritual aspirations are just such a nuisance? You know, everything was just fine. until this happened. Until they came back from the forest. I was impressed once. Someone told me that her children were raised at Ananda but have gone into another life completely. But she heard her daughter speaking to a friend on the phone, and they were talking about the inescapability of their upbringing at Ananda. And one friend said to another, they were both from the community. Yeah, she said, all our friends just do whatever they want, but we always have to think about the deeper meaning of everything. Well, that's how Duryodhana felt. If I can just get rid of these guys for a while, it'll be just fine. So Dhritarashtra decides he'll go along with this plan. So he tells them that there's this beautiful city. It's called Varanavata. He said, why don't you go there for a while? Why don't you just go on a long holiday to that city, see other places, and so on. Now, Yudhisthira, a theme throughout the whole Mahabharata, which is a strong theme in Indian culture, kept alive by these epics, is this obedience to your elders. I mean, it's hard sometimes for Americans to understand when an Indian person will come and say, well, my mother wants me to do this. An American will tend to say, and? You know? But it's just not easy in that culture because it's so strongly inculcated in many Asian cultures, this respect for parents, respect for elders, and it's right here in this epic. Yudhisthira is always bound by what his elders say. When we get to the Ramayana, it's the same thing. Even if they're wrong, his principle is that he has to respect the elders. So he knows Dhritarashtra doesn't mean well for him and that this is not really a good idea for him, but he's the soul of Dharma. And Dhritarashtra is like a father to him because his father has passed away, so he says, yes, of course that will go. Now, as soon as Dhritarashtra makes the arrangement for him to leave, he sets in motion this plot. And he calls this one of his ministers to him, a man named Puruchana, and he says to him, I want you to go ahead to that city, and I want you to hastily construct a beautiful palace so that when the Pandava brothers get there, you can say, oh, my lords, this palace has been constructed for you. Would you please come and honor us by living here? And then Dhritarashtra tells him, he said, make that palace out of intensely flammable materials. And after they have gotten comfortable and have lived there for some period of time and have become relaxed and confident, then we can burn that house down with all of them in it, and we'll be done with them forever. Isn't that right? This is what the, you know, worldly desires want to do. We just want to get rid of these annoying spiritual aspirations. And sometimes we try to do that, don't we? We just try to burn them down. We leave the ashram. We go back to worldly habits. We marry a very materialistic person. We go out and get money. We come back to the ashram and try to tell everyone how happy we are now. We just really want to get rid of it. Right? So Dhritarashtra, the blind mind, plots that will just lure them into this beautiful house and we'll just burn them to the ground and then it'll all be done. Now, the citizens, of course, didn't want them to leave because they loved this was their home country and they loved the Pandavas, but Yudhisthira insisted and so off they went. Now, Vidura, the all-seeing wise Vidura, who can read the blind mind even when the mind thinks it's hidden from him. He knows what Dhritarashtra is planning. And so as they're walking out of town, Vidura begins to speak in a language known to very few. And he says a few words. And he speaks about fire. He speaks about poison. He talks about how even the rats can make a burrow underground. So even if the whole forest burns down, you know, they'll be protected in their underground place. And after he walks away, Bhima and the brothers come up and said, what was he talking about? And he said, I think it's going to be fire, is what he answers like that. So then they settle in this town, and they stay for a while in one house or another, and Puruchana builds this house and then invites them to stay in it. And Yudhisthira knows perfectly well what's going on, but he's been cautioned, and he recognizes that the time is not ripe yet. Now, this is also a wise aspect of spiritual aspiration. Sometimes spiritual aspiration has to be a little bit strategic in its confrontation with material desires. Because if the time isn't ripe, you won't necessarily succeed. And often if you provoke the confrontation too soon, not only will you not succeed, but you will actually lose ground. In a very small way, Swamiji talks about when he first became zealous for the spiritual path, he started taking cold showers, thought he would make himself tough. And he said, but he took so many cold showers that he reached the point where he just couldn't get warm for months and months at a time. And it simply wasn't strategic at that time. So one of the other things that Yudhishthira tells us is he knows ultimately there's going to be a battle to the death, but he also bides his time. Both sides bide their time, waiting until they get strong. So they move into this house, and shortly after they move in, a messenger comes from Hastinapura, just a simple man, who begins to talk to Yudhishthira in the same unknown dialect. And it turns out that this man is an engineer and a miner, one who goes under the ground. And he's been sent by Vidura to provide the escape hatch, because they walk around this beautiful palace that has been built for him, and they see it's built entirely out of flammable materials. And there's jars of oil and, you know, piles of wax, just everything that's there. It seems a little transparent, but maybe they thought they could get away with it. So the miner begins to make this tunnel. And there's this house even has a moat around it, so the miner has to tunnel way underground to go under the water to get all the way out. And they need to get out of the house, but Purochana hangs around all the time. So the Pandavas develop a great interest in hunting. And almost every day they go out and ride in the woods, and so this minister has to go with them. And in the meantime, they get really familiar with the lay of the land, and they know everything that's there. So it's been about a year, and now the miner has finished his tunnel, and they have it, it's in the center. The entrance is in the courtyard, and it's covered with a rug, and only the Pandavas know it's there. And they begin to feel that time is running out, and they hold a family council with their mother, and they say, you know, we need to strike before they strike at us. So there's a friend of Purochana, this low-caste woman who has five sons herself. So they invite them to come for a dinner, and then they feed them a great deal of inebriating beverages until they are, this woman and her sons and the evil Purochana are completely drunk and passed out. And then they go around and set the house on fire themselves, pull back the rug, go down into the tunnel, and then suddenly the house is in flames. And the whole town, seeing the fire, runs, but there's a moat around and they can't get across. Besides, the fire is so hot, they just have to watch the place burn to the ground. And Bhima decides wisely that they will leave the entrance hole uncovered because all the debris will fall into it. And of course, that will be then the signal to Vidura and those who come after that they were able to get away. So they go a great distance underground and come up by the river. And there they find that a boatman has been stationed there by Vidura, and for the entire year he's been waiting. Vidura told him every night, one of these nights the Pandava brothers will come and you must be ready. So again, we have the servant of the Lord waits, servant of righteousness waits, the Pandavas come, they're taken across the river, and then they flee. Word gets back, and then they go into the house and they discover, oh my goodness, the evil minister was killed, but also there's a woman's body and five male bodies, and the word goes back that the Pandavas are dead. And Dhritarashtra, of course, is secretly overjoyed, but he has to pretend this great, great sorrow, and that he feels like his plot has been done, and Duryodhana thinks, finally, you know, finally I've gotten rid of them for good. Poor Duryodhana, he keeps thinking he's gotten rid of them for good. He poisons Bhima, you know, now he burns them down, and each time he thinks, this is it. This time, finally, I've finally gotten rid of them. And then these spiritual things just keep burrowing back in and making a nuisance of themselves. And he just cannot get a hold of that kingdom and keep it. That's the good news. Okay. So now, the Pandavas are fleeing through the forest. They don't know exactly where they're going to go. And in the forest, they meet Vyasa. And Vyasa offers them a great deal of comfort, including these very wise words, even the virtuous do not always live in comfort. and even the evil do not always live in sorrow. So be patient, whatever comes to you. You know, the tides of life will rise and fall. And he suggests that they disguise themselves as Brahmins and go to this particular town called Ekachakra, which is where they go to live. But on the way, they have a little adventure which is worth noting. They go to a forest by a beautiful lake. And unbeknownst to them, this forest is controlled by a Rakshasa. Rakshasas come into this play every once in a while, and in very short words, they're big evil demons. And they're extremely powerful, and they become more powerful at night. And periodically, Rakshasas terrorize everybody. And they're very hard to defeat because they have so many magical powers and so much inherent strength. So there's this evil Rakshasa called Hidimba. And Hidimba controls this forest. And he has a sister, Hidimbi, who's also a Rakshasa. And so they smell the human beings and they feast on human flesh. And Hidimba says, oh, I'm very hungry and I haven't had a delicious human in a long time. And he sends his sister to go kill these human beings and then drag them back for dinner. Okay, but Hidimbi is walking through the forest, and I'm sure this story is partly just added here because it's so entertaining. And she spies through the trees Bhima, and she has never seen a man as powerful as Bhima, and she becomes totally entranced with him. Periodically in these stories, people fall in love with each other, all the themes of human life. You know, the curse of the rishi, the boons, and the love at first sight, sometimes thwarted, sometimes won, who knows. Hidimbi falls in love with Bhima. She's smart enough to recognize that he's not going to like her much as a Rakshasa. But one of the qualities of Rakshasas is that they have the magical power to assume any form they want. So she decides that she's going to win this magnificent human by assuming the form of a beautiful human woman herself. So she makes herself lovely and modest and humble and attractive in all ways. And all of the family is resting. They are exhausted from the fleeing from the castle, the palace, and the burning and the going underground. And Bhima is standing watch over all of them. So she just goes to Bhima, attracts his attention, and then while the others are sleeping, tries to persuade him to run away with her. She said, I will make you very happy. I am powerful over all these woods. You know, you can be my husband and we will be happy everywhere together. And Bhima points to his family and he said, you know, certainly you are a beautiful woman and I am flattered by your attentions, but these are my brothers and my mother and I have a duty to them. I absolutely cannot leave them. You see all the cultural values that are built into this. Oh, but love is more important than anything. No, he says, duty is more important than this. And meanwhile, Hidimba, the brother Rakshasa, is getting hungrier and hungrier, and he wonders what's keeping his dinner. So he starts creeping up, and he sees his sister, because he can penetrate her disguise, and he makes a roaring noise. What are you doing here? And then Hidimbi says, oh, my brother is so powerful, he can defeat everyone. Come, you must run away with me. And Bhima says, I am not afraid of anyone. Let him come. I will defend my brother and my mother against this. And so all of a sudden, Hidimba attacks Bhima, and the two of them begin to fight. And the way it's always described is Bhima uproots a tree. He always uproots a tree. I'm not quite sure what it means, but he always uproots a tree and goes to battle with an uprooted tree. I think we're just trying to show how powerful he is, or it has other significance. Who knows? So all of a sudden, Kunti and the other four brothers who've just been exhausted wake up and they see several things happening. They see this huge Rakshasa. They see Bhima having a huge battle for his life with this big creature. And they see this beautiful woman staring with love-struck eyes at Bhima. And they begin to laugh at the whole picture until Bhima defeats Hidimba, breaks him into pieces, and frees the forest from his terrible curse. Now, Kunti says to the woman who confesses that she is in fact a Rakshasa, but she is in love with Kunti's son, Bhima. And Kunti looks over at her son and sees that he's not completely averse to the idea. And then Adimbi says things like, it's not right. If a woman loves a man as I love your husband, he must respond. It's cruel not to respond. So you have all these cultural norms begun to be built in here. And so finally, they make an agreement. And Bhima says, I have to stay with my family, but I will stay with you long enough for us to have a son together. And then once the son is born, then I have to go back to my family. So they have their little time together. And in the course of time, she becomes pregnant, and she gives birth to a half-rakshasa, half-human. However, who is a very powerful warrior, and in an extremely key moment in the final battle, the son, Ghatakocha, is his name. He plays a very important role in saving the cause of righteousness. So, there we have it. So, let's take a break. Let's start again, please.
Before you start, can I just mention one thing? I'm listening to the recordings. I realize that you don't have to hold this mic really up close. It's really small.
Okay, let's go.
So they knew, Bhima and the Pandavas knew that she was this evil demon.
Hidimbi. Hidimbi, yes.
Yeah.
She wasn't an evil demon. She was of that race.
Oh.
Yeah, she was a Rakshasa, which, you know, was of a certain race, and lots of them were demons.
Okay.
It's a little confusing.
I'm certain that
Sai Ganesha has a long answer, but I'm not going to ask him to give it right now. I'm sure that, because, you know, the people who've spent centuries sorting this out will sort this out. So my answer is the crummy Western answer.
I was going to say, you did say something beforehand that was just a little side note, so we'll leave it at that.
The Rakshasas are the demons, the demon race generally, but the offspring of Hidimbi and Bhima actually turns out to be Ghatakocha, who's a very powerful warrior who, as I say, really saves the Pandavas at a very critical moment with his tremendous power. So it's like nobody's entirely one or the other. You know, there's a bad seed, but then they come out okay on the other side. And she, of course, fell in love with Bhima, so she must have had some goodness in her because she, you know, fell in love with him instead of just eating him, which is what she had been sent to do. So part of it is that there's just no clear-cut answers. But I also think that part of it all has been added over time by the storytellers just for the fun of it. I was also asked another question, which is basically, if the Battle of Kurukshetra is the story of the soul's evolution from materialism to spirituality, like, is it only for advanced souls or does it cover everyone? And part of it, we have to really realize this, these stories were created when Kali Yuga was beginning the story in order to keep the truths alive. So it can be told on many different levels. And I'm telling the story from the point of view that interests us the most, which is the symbolic spiritual nature of these various characters and how they war against each other and represent things. And certain of them are much more important to us. So there's all kinds of ways you could tell this story. You could emphasize all different aspects of it. Just for pure righteous living, obey your parents. You know, do your duty, follow the dharma that's laid out for you by society. You could tell the story from many different angles, and people do tell it from many different angles. I think I mentioned at the beginning, when I was talking about this, about being in a temple in New Delhi in which there was a huge number of carvings on the wall illustrating all of these traditional stories, and watching literally a group of illiterate people seeing the pictures. And even though I couldn't understand their language, it was so clear that the pictures communicated so much to them that got them so happy and involved. And so it's just, we understand it on whatever level we want to understand it. And it goes all the way from Krishna to the most evil people here and everything in between. And just the average citizens just trying to have their little life and all the different things that happen. But it did descend from a higher age. You know, it was at the transition between Dwapara, Krishna incarnated at the end of Dwapara, the beginning of Kali, descending, which is, of course, exactly where we are now. So they had the memory of a higher age. In the Ramayana, which was at the end, I believe it was at the transition between Treta Yuga and Dwapara Yuga, or reputed to be just at that point. At the very end of the Ramayana, a fishwife was heard arguing with her husband. And everyone said, ah, the golden age is over. Because it was just the beginning of what is where we're just heading now. But still, disharmony was possible between those who were supposed to love each other, and then they knew that the hard times were coming. And in this story, when we finally get on the battlefield, Krishna condones certain things that were considered utterly dishonorable. And Krishna then has to say, too late, Kali Yuga's coming. This is just what you have to do in these times. It's not possible to be quite as clean and pure as we've been up until now, because it's a new age, and evil has too much power. We have to borrow a little bit of its strength in order to succeed. So these are big lessons. Yes, Marilyn has a question.
How can it be relative if there's only one truth?
Because it's directional. Truth is directional. Relative means that it's, you know, the word relative is relative to something. If you have a center here, you can be at all different places in relationship to it. If you have a center here, if you're south of it, you have to go north to reach it. If you're north of it, you have to go south. So you can't say that north is the direction to reach truth. You have to say wherever you are arrayed in relation to it, you go to it. We were talking about this in a different group this morning. I was actually commenting, I had just read, listened to the audiobook of Nelson Mandela's autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. It's a very interesting book. And just different dharmas for different people. There's a certain point at which the willingness to go to war and sacrifice your life for a cause you believe in is progress. And there's another point at which to pick up a gun and shoot someone, even in war, would be unthinkable. It just depends on where you are. If you're only living for yourself and your own pleasure, and then suddenly you have an ideal that's bigger than you and you're willing to go forward toward it, that's expansive for you. Relative to where you're standing and where you're going, that's forward. And for someone else who's on the other side of that, it might be backwards. Nationalism could be contractive, whereas nationalism for someone else could be expansive.
And so also for the ages or the yugas, that's also the truth?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that.
It's a tricky point, and when we get to there, it's a hard point to understand. But Krishna says it's okay to do this, and he has Yudhishthira commit a dishonorable act. And there's a lot of criticism, but Krishna says it's necessary. We couldn't have defeated them otherwise. And it's not quite the end justifies the means, but it's a little complicated, yeah? I mean, that's why, like right now, even, I'll use a very little example, but people become infatuated with diet, as people do on the spiritual path, and we get engaged, and we think we'll have raw foods, or only grapes, or whatever it is. And Swamiji remarked once, it was very interesting, and he was quoting Master. He said, this age on the planet is too gross, too unsubtle for us to make significant spiritual progress merely by physical purification. He said, in this age, devotion is the path. In higher ages where everything is more subtle and the grip of matter is more delicate, then just a little nuance, a little adjusting of the physical molecules can make a huge difference, but not in Kali Yuga. So Master didn't put strong emphasis beyond a certain point on purity of diet, because he said in this age it's just not gonna work. So you can extrapolate from that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay? I mean, these are very subtle points, though. It's not like they're obvious. All right. So, the Pandavas go live disguised as Brahmins in this town of this town that Vyasa has sent them to, Ekachakra. And every day, they follow the Brahmin habit and they go out and beg their food. And here we have amusing stories, which is everything that they beg, they gather together, they bring it back to their mother, and the mother divides it in half. She gives half of it to Bhima, and she gives half of the rest of it to the rest of them. And then they tell the story about how Bhima gets someone, a potter friend, to make him a gigantic begging bowl, and then he goes out into the town with this huge bowl with the citizens of the town fill. But Bhima is always hungry. And this is a very difficult part of living in this way. His enormous appetite is never satisfied. And they live for almost a year in this, they rent a house from a Brahmin family, and then one day the peace of their life is interrupted by this weeping and wailing from the family of the landlord, and they overhear this discussion, and only Bhima and Kunti are home at the time. The other brothers are out gathering their food for the day. And it turns out, Kunti goes over and inquires, and it turns out that this town is also under the control of an evil Rakshasa. And that Rakshasa used to wander into town randomly and steal people to eat them. And so the town made an agreement with the Rakshasa, which is once a week, the town would send the Rakshasa a huge cart of food and one citizen. And that responsibility would go from house to house. And what had happened was this Brahmin family had been selected. It was their turn. And one member of the family was going to have to sacrifice himself. The mother wanted to sacrifice herself, the father, the son, the daughter. This terrible conversation is going around. And Kunti says, there's no need. I have five sons. My son is very powerful. We can send him to meet this Rakshasa. And there's some argument back and forth, but finally Kunti absolutely insists that she will send her son, knowing that her son will be able to defeat the Rakshasa. Bhima is all for the plan when he realizes that an entire cart of food is also going out there. So they arrange for him to have the cart delivered, and the Brahmin family cooks all night and fills the cart with delicious food, and it's also mentioned that she's a very good cook. And Bhima is very happy about this. And so he drives this cart with the cattle, which are going to be eaten, and all the food in the cart, and himself was meant for the Rakshasa. And when he's on the hill and he's near the cave where the Rakshasa is, it occurs to him that after he does battle with the Rakshasa, he'll be impure because of the blood that will be shed, and that he won't be able to enjoy all of this food. So he sits down on the hill and eats everything that there is to eat. These are ridiculous stories, but they're entertaining. In any case, the Rakshasa spies him and becomes very enraged, and Bhima holds him off while he finishes the last of the curds, as it's described. And then, of course, with great power, defeats the Rakshasa and frees the city of the curse. So the Pandavas act as noble people ought to act. Whenever they find that there's trouble that they can solve, they do their best to solve it, even at great cost to themselves. This is another one of the cultural stories that's embedded in here, that even when they see others are suffering and they have the power to alleviate that suffering, they step in and do it. They don't stand back and say, this is not for me to do. So now what's happening is the time has passed, and you know the timeline of this epic is a little obscure, so let's not try to exactly figure it out. But Drupada has done his austerities. He has his son Drishtadyumna, and he has his daughter Draupadi. Now, of course, he has this daughter because he wants to give her to Arjuna to be his bride, and he's heard, of course, that the Pandavas were killed. And he doesn't quite know how to reconcile these two because this daughter was born to be the wife of Arjuna, but the Pandavas apparently are no more. So he decides that he's going to have a swayamvara, which is this event where a woman is allowed to choose her own husband. And she has a garland, and she garlands the man that she wants to be her husband. And as is often the case in these things, there's also a test of skill involved, and no one can qualify for her to choose him unless he first strings this very powerful bow and manages to send five arrows through the eye of a fish, which is a target, which is way high, high in the tree there. And so the word is spread everywhere. Drupada sends the word all through every city, because if the Pandavas are anywhere, he wants them to hear about it. So this town crier comes, and when the Pandavas hear about this event, Kunti senses that it attracts them and they are restless. So she says, I'm growing tired of this town. Why don't we go to this other city where Drupada is having this event? So all the kings have come to this great event, and the Pandavas are still in disguise. They are disguised as Brahmins. They don't come there openly. They're just going to stroll in and just see what's happening. And Duryodhana is there, and Karna is there, and kings from everywhere. And Krishna comes with his brother. And as the story is told, this is the first time that the Pandavas and Krishna meet, even though they are, in fact, cousins. Krishna's father is the brother of Kunti. So they are cousins. But in the story, this is the first time that they meet. So this huge Swayamvara is held, and Draupadi is just this exquisitely beautiful woman in every way, and she's wealthy and comes from this powerful family, so it's a tremendous prize. So Duryodhana struggles but doesn't quite succeed. Karna comes and strings the bow and shoots the arrows, but they say he misses by just a hair. He just barely misses, and everyone is quite concerned, but Krishna is standing there, and he's speaking to his brother Balarama, and he looks around the area where the Brahmins are sitting, and one by one, he sees the five Pandavas, and he mentions to his brother, look who's there, disguised as the Brahmins, you see. So now all the Kshatriyas have tried to win this woman, and none have succeeded, and there's beginning to be this kind of grumbling among all the kings. He set a prize, he said he was going to give his daughter away, but he sets a contest that no one can fulfill. This is not an honorable test. Everybody's always ready to fight over something. And so Arjuna steps out, still in disguise, from the ranks of the Brahmins, and he says to Drupada, he said, all the Kshatriyas have tried. Can someone from the Brahmin group try? And Drupada says, if you can meet my test, I have promised my daughter, to whoever it is, a Shudra, Vaishya, Brahmin, or Kshatriya, whoever can do this. So Arjuna comes forward, and he picks up the arrow, strings it easily, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 arrows right into the eye of the fish. And so Draupadi takes the garland and puts it over him, and there it's done. Now, Drupada is crestfallen because this daughter was for Arjuna, and now this Brahmin has won. But Krishna's quite pleased with what he sees. And Drishtadyumna, her brother, is a little suspicious about what's going on here. So they start back. The five brothers now, the Brahmins, they're taking Draupadi with them, and they're going back to where Mother Kunti is. And when they're a little distance from home, one of the brothers calls out, Mother, we have brought back with us some wonderful thing. And she says, share it equally among yourselves as you always do, my sons. This is a woman. She's supposed to be Arjuna's wife. And now the mother, and when they come around the corner and you realize that what they have brought is a wife, she's horrified. She doesn't know what to think. At the same time, she's never spoken an untruth in her life. I don't know exactly how they fit in abandoning Karna as a baby in that. But in any case, maybe nobody ever asked her, so she never had to lie about it. But in any case, she's never spoken an untruth in her life. You see, this is the age in which they're coming from. And her word cannot be falsified, so they don't quite know what to do about this. And meanwhile, Drishtadyumna has followed, and he's watching from a distance, and he listens, and he sees that there are five brothers and this noble-looking woman, and all of their conversation, as he goes back and tells his father, is about Kshatriya matters. They're talking about war and power and weapons and glory, and they're not talking like Brahmins at all. And he goes back to his father and he says, I believe that these are the Pandavas. So Drupada sends word and asks that his daughter and her new husband and the family come and meet him, because now he wants to give them a proper wedding. So they come together there, and everything seems to be in order, except then they tell him that all five of the brothers are going to marry her. And this is quite out of the ordinary. Men are easily allowed multiple wives. It's not a problem for them. But women are not allowed multiple husbands. And Yudhishthira also confesses that, pure-minded as he is, he also had a desire to be married to this wife. And he too knows that no unrighteous idea would arise in his mind. So they send for Vyasa because they just don't know what to do. And Vyasa consults the scriptures and consults, and he says, it's unusual, but in this case, it's all right. Now, the symbolism of this, which is the only way you can possibly interpret it, is that Draupadi represents the Kundalini energy. She's the Shakti power of all of them, and they represent the five chakras. And the Kundalini power moves equally through all of the chakras, and so must be equally dispersed among them. So they give you this image of this one woman with five husbands. But that's what how the story is told, because the Shakti belongs to all of them. And now, once Vyasa accepts it, I mean, once Vyasa has declared, Drupada has no objection, and he's thrilled. His life ambition has been fulfilled. He has given this birth to this beautiful and powerful daughter, and now she belongs to Arjuna, who is the power of self-control. She is the Kundalini energy. Okay. Now, the news gets back to Hastinapura, and Vidura is overjoyed, and he tells Dhritarashtra, a strong alliance has been made between the house of the Kurus and the house of Drupada. Dhritarashtra thinks his son Duryodhana has won the bride, and he's overjoyed. But then Vidura very strategically says, oh, not actually. It wasn't Duryodhana. It was the Pandava brothers who seem actually to have miraculously escaped the burning house. So Dhritarashtra once again is caught in this necessity to be utterly hypocritical when his mind and his soul is just burning up. And Duryodhana is furious. And now you see the Pandavas are really gaining power because they have now made an alliance with the Kundalini. So before, the five chakras were sort of looking for their power, and they were a little hesitant to confront Duryodhana, but now they have married the Kundalini energy, and that Kundalini energy belongs to all five of them. And so Duryodhana is terrified, and even Dhritarashtra is terrified, because now they have made an alliance with dispassion, and with the brother is the inner light and the Kundalini energy. And so now the Pandavas are beginning to get their force aligned in such a way that they know they're going to be able to defeat them in time. So, Duryodhana, led by Karna, wants to just go out and do battle with them and try to just knock them off the planet right away. But Vidura, Dhritarashtra, and even Bhishma, the ego, says, no, no, we have to make peace. Bhishma says, we have to find a way to coexist, because the ego knows that you're just not going to be able to defeat this force. It's getting too powerful. So they all go to Hastinapura. They're invited. Dhritarashtra pretends this great joy. They invite the whole family back. Krishna comes with them. And when they go to the women's apartments, the mother of Duryodhana and all her brothers, Gandhari, remember, she put the cloth over her eyes when she married her blind husband. She didn't think it was right if he couldn't see that she would see. So she's, because of this tremendous sacrifice, again, you see the complexity of things, she's given birth to this king of material desire, but she herself has lived this life of purity and self-sacrifice. So when Draupadi comes to her, because she doesn't have physical sight, she has inner sight. And in many occasions, Gandhari is her name, she sees things that others don't see. And as soon as Draupadi comes, she says, ah, this woman is going to be the death of all my sons. Okay, the Kundalini energy has awakened. It has wedded itself to all the chakras, and she knows that the days of her dishonest and materialistic sons are numbered now. That this woman will wipe them all out, because when the Kundalini rises, all of those desires and forces are just obliterated. And that is, in fact, how it all comes out. So Dhritarashtra decides that he's going to turn over half the kingdom to the Pandava brothers because they can't coexist. So he gives them a godforsaken section of the kingdom and says, you just go and live in that, he calls it that wonderful part, and we'll live in this part and we'll all just coexist together very nicely. And he sends them off to this wilderness, but because of their righteousness and the spiritual power that comes with it, that wilderness soon becomes a paradise. And of course the symbolism of it is too obvious, which is wherever there is righteousness, there is also beauty. And the architects from the astral worlds come and build this beautiful palace. And Yudhishthira is persuaded that it is the right of kings to become more and more powerful, and he holds this great ceremony, which declares himself the emperor of all, gives him a position higher than any of the other kings, and they express their power, and they kill a few evil people, and finally everyone comes, and they have this huge event. But all the jealousies are still there, and of all the kings that are there, now the Pandavas have made a strong alliance with Krishna. So one king has to be honored among the guests, and they honor Krishna and many others who are just put off by this. Who is he? He's merely the foster child of a cowherd. He's just a minor king. He's no one. Why are they honoring him so much? And so all the forces of materialism look right at Krishna and can't see him and just think that he's nothing. And the forces of righteousness look at Krishna and know that he's the Lord of them all. And they have built this beautiful palace, but it's been built in a magical way that anyone who moves through it with jealousy is confused by what he sees. So Duryodhana is invited to go through this beautiful palace of the Pandavas, but he's confused. He looks and he sees it, thinks it's a door and it's actually a wall, and so he walks into a wall. He imagines that it's a solid floor and it's a pool of water, and he falls into a pool of water. He imagines it's a pool of water and walks carefully around it, and it's nothing but the tiled floor. And so he's just made a fool of. He can't relate to the spiritual home that has been created out of righteousness. He keeps misreading it. His jealousy confuses his mind, and he becomes more and more enraged. And when he goes back, he says to his father, "I cannot bear this. Even half the kingdom is too much." Because spirituality and material desire cannot coexist. The blind mind keeps thinking, "Oh, it'll be okay, we can both get along." But it one or the other. This is the spiritual path. It's a narrow path. So finally, Duryodhana persuades his father that he really has a solution. And that solution is offered by his evil uncle, Shakuni. And Shakuni is another one of these terrible ones. I wanted to say exactly who he is. He is the sense of I, the power to create illusions, to bewilder the enemy, which is the power of I. That's what Shakuni is, this thought that I exist as a separate entity and that I am all-powerful. That's what Shakuni is. Now, Shakuni is the evil uncle of Duryodhana, and he, all king material desire, the evil uncle is the sense of self that always wants to gratify itself. And Duryodhana persuades Dhritarashtra that Shakuni has a plan, and we're going to get rid of them once and for all. And so Vidura is persuaded, much against his better judgment, to go to where the Pandavas are, to invite them to Hastinapura, to engage in a game of dice. And they try to explain this by saying gambling was a king's profession, and it was considered cowardly and dishonorable not to accept a challenge to gamble if it was offered to you. So Vidura goes to Yudhisthira, and Vidura is very distressed. And Yudhisthira sees his distress, and Vidura says, "I am charged to issue this invitation. Gambling is the root of many evils." He said, "I strongly suggested that we not issue this invitation, but Dhritarashtra insisted." And he said, "Now do as you wish." Vidura wouldn't advise him. So Yudhisthira accepted. Sometimes people say that he had a reputation for weakness for gambling. They try to explain, why did he ever accept this invitation? And sometimes it's put this way, well, sometimes spirituality becomes a little oversure of itself and it gambles a little with delusion. But spirituality should never gamble with delusion because the dice are loaded. The other reason is that Yudhisthira was bound by his code of honor to obey the wishes of his elders. The other was that he knew that inevitably there would be a final conflict, and he wanted to do everything possible to not be the cause of that. So he accepted the invitation. So all the Pandavas go back to Hastinapura, and a great pavilion has been set up, and they're going to play this game of dice. And Yudhisthira, because the invitation was issued by Duryodhana, imagines that Duryodhana is going to play. But when they get there, turns out that Shakuni is going to play instead. And Yudhishthira says, this is very irregular. Usually a man plays for himself. Oh, and then Shakuni says, you're a coward, are you? And Yudhishthira is taunted by that. And so he says, well, I'll go ahead and play. So they start the wager. And first, they wager money and they wager gold. And every time they throw the dice are loaded. And Shakuni says, I have won. So money is wagered. Jewels are wagered. The dice is thrown. And he says every time, Shakuni says, I have won. So then they start wagering their weapons. Then their elephants. Then their horses. And finally, they start wagering the land that they possess, village by village, and the flocks of cattle and the sheep, every measure of wealth and power that Yudhishthira and the Pandava brothers have gathered, piece by piece by piece. Shakuni throws the dice, and every time it's all stacked against Yudhishthira, and Shakuni declares, I have won. Finally, everything external is gone. So he begins to take from his own body his personal ornaments. He takes from his brothers his personal ornaments. Time after time, Shakuni wins. And finally, Shakuni says, it seems that I have won everything. What else do you have left? And then he suggests to him, well, you still have your brothers. So Sahadev is wagered and lost. Nakula is wagered and lost. And then Shakuni says, well, of course, you were willing to give them up because, after all, they're only your half-brothers. And Yudhishthira is outraged by such an insult, and so he wagers Arjuna, and he is lost. He wagers Bhima, and he is lost. And finally, he wagers himself, and he is lost. So then Shakuni says, there's still one thing left, and that's your wife, Draupadi. And Yudhishthira by now is completely lost. His discrimination is gone, and he wagers his wife. Shakuni says, I have won. So Duryodhana and his brothers are jubilant. Shakuni's plot has worked better than they'd ever imagined. All their wealth is gone. Their personal freedom is gone. Now even their wife is gone. And Duryodhana says to Vidura, go and bring Draupadi to this gathering now. She belongs now, not to them, but to us. And Vidura says, come to your senses. He said, you are, because he's now, you see, material desire is going to touch the fire of Kundalini and imagine that he can survive. And Vidura is wise enough to know, he says, you are hanging over the edge of an abyss, but you can still draw back. But if you go forward in what you are saying, everything will be destroyed. And so Duryodhana pays no attention, and he sends one of his servants to get Draupadi. And he goes to Draupadi's place, and she says, Duryodhana wants you to come. You will be his maidservant from now on. Your husband, Yudhishthira, has wagered everything, including you, and now you are lost. Draupadi sends back the question, when you wagered me, I ask you, my husband, had you already lost yourself? In other words, if you had lost yourself, you had no right to wager me. Yudhishthira makes no reply. He can't say anything. And Duryodhana becomes even more anxious, but the servant is unable to move the queen, Draupadi. She won't listen. So he sends his brother Dusashana, who represents anger. When desire is thwarted, anger comes forth. And she still refuses to come, and he grabs her by the hair, and he drags her into the assembly. Now remember, you know, when Bhishma touched Amba's hand, Salva wouldn't deal with her at all anymore. It's an insult beyond measure. He drags her by her hair. And Draupadi masters herself. She's a very powerful force. And she challenges all the elders. How could you allow this to happen? Had he already wagered himself? Did he have the right to wager me? You know, don't forsake me. How can you preside over such a dishonorable situation? All the Yudhishthira remains silent, and all the brothers subservient to him are bound in their silence. But Bhima finally cannot stand it any longer, and he begins to rage at Yudhishthira for this terrible thing that has been done. And then all of a sudden Arjuna sees what is happening. The Pandavas are now warring against each other. And he puts his hand on Bhima and he says, their plot is working. Be silent, my brother. So even though they are furious, they simply stand. And suddenly the whole assembly sort of comes to its senses and sees what's going on here. And for a moment it looks like they're going to come back. But then Karna stands up and he says, look, this is just a fine point of law. What difference does it make? Yudhishthira had lost everything. He didn't have to wager her separately. The wife belongs to the husband. Everything was lost, including himself, and that includes her. Even the clothes that they're wearing now belong to us. So the Pandavas strip off their clothes and throw them on the ground. And then they look at, Duryodhana looks at Draupadi and says, and the clothes that she's wearing. Oh my gosh. And seeing that no one is saving her. Duryodhana sends his brother Dusasana and he grabs the end of her sari. He's going to pull it off. And then Draupadi surrenders herself to Krishna. She realizes that no earthly aid is going to save her. She begins to pray only to Lord Krishna. And then the way the story is told, Dusasana pulls and pulls and pulls and pulls and hundreds of yards of sari come off of her. But still, she remains completely wrapped. And Bhima, watching Dusasana commit this outrage against their beautiful wife, says, I will rip your heart from your chest and drink the blood from it while it still beats. Oh my God. And then Duryodhana says, you know, make all the threats you want. You're just a slave. And then he turns to Draupadi and he says, your husbands are nothing anymore. You can choose from any of us who you want to be. And then he lifts his leg and shows her his bare leg just to invite her to tell her who he is. Bhima looks at that leg and says, I will break that thigh on the field of battle. He said, even as you still live, I will break that thigh that you have shown. And then each of the brothers, except Yudhishthira, takes some solemn vow of the vengeance that they're going to wreak on this terrible family because of what they're doing. Dhritarashtra becomes absolutely panic-stricken because he sees the power of the Pandavas and he realizes what they're doing and what they're playing with by touching this woman in this way. This is the kundalini power, and even material desire cannot stand against it. So suddenly he tries to smooth it over, and he, my daughter, come to me. He said, it's all been a mistake. I grant you a boon. What would you like? She said, I would like my husband Yudhishthira to be freed. Yes, yes, and ask for another boon. Free the others of my husbands. And yes, yes, what more do you want? She says, nothing more. And so they all walk out of the hall. And everything seems to be canceled. But Duryodhana is absolutely infuriated, and he and his people walk out, and then he sees Yudhishthira and the Pandavas just walking out free. This whole thing that he's just done, and then they're all just leaving. He becomes outraged, and he runs back to his father, who's so just manipulatable by this spoiled son. And so he persuades his father, one more throw of the dice, and they send out and get the Pandavas to come, and Shakuni explains what the gamble is going to be. We will throw the dice one more time, and whoever loses will be exiled for 12 years, must go off and live in the forest. And in the 13th year, you must hide yourself, you must disguise yourself and live incognito without being discovered for one more year. He said, and that will be, and if you are discovered during that year, then you must go off into exile for 12 more years. Yudhishthira feels that he must cooperate with fate, however it comes to him, and they shake the dice. Shakuni says, I have won. So now the Pandavas are exiled, and they leave the city, and each goes in a certain way. Yudhishthira goes with his eyes downcast, because his righteous power, if he raised his eyes, would turn to ashes, everything he looked at. Bhima is thinking, he's feeling the power of his arms, and he's thinking of the revenge that he's going to wreak. Arjuna is scattering ashes, symbolizing all the arrows he's going to shoot. And Draupadi weeps and weeps, and she's weeping the sorrow that the women of Duryodhana's household will weep when vengeance is finally theirs. So Dhritarashtra, Duryodhana becomes very frightened a little bit by all of this, and he pleads with Drona to support them. He says, you know, he's king material desire. He pleads with past habit to stick with him. And Drona says, well, I have eaten the bread of this household from all my life. He said, but I will defend this household, but Dharma and righteousness are on the side of the Pandavas. I urge you to make peace with them, or else we will all be defeated. And that's it for tonight.